This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoen. Kids for Cash is a new documentary about two judges in Pennsylvania, Mark Chivarella and Michael Conahan, and a kickback scheme that landed them in prison. In Judge Chivarella's courtroom in Luzerne County, teenagers, many charged with petty crimes, were sent to detention centers in the state after a procedure that lasted just a few minutes. They often had no legal representation, no prior record, and were led away in handcuffs. The judges accepted a finder's fee from the builder of these two detention centers. While Conahan has accepted some legal responsibility for his actions, Chivarella has not. Robert May is the producer and director of this film and got the two judges to sit for interviews, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And congratulations on the film. And Robert May, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. He's joined with, by Marsha Levick, Deputy Director, Chief Legal Counsel of the Juvenile Law Center here in Philadelphia, which worked to expose the injustices that took place at this courthouse and in this courtroom. And Marsha Levick, nice to have you with us on Radio Times once again to talk about this important story.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And joining us by telephone is Terry Morgan Biesecker, staff reporter for the Scranton Times Tribune, one of the lead writers on this story. And Terry, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
It's good to be here.
Let me begin with you, Robert May, and I should say to our listeners and to you that Marsha has been on the show a number of times talking about this case, this story. What got you interested?
Listening to Marsha talk about the story.
There you go.
Now, I actually have a home in Luzerne County, and we were developing a fiction film about greed and corruption from the coal mining days, literally, and when the story broke in January 2009. And it was a story about greed and corruption happening before our eyes, and I was just sort of mesmerized by the story, and also sort of by the one-dimensional view I thought was being portrayed by the story as well.
The one-dimensional view meaning cash for kids,
right? I mean, all of the articles I read and the radio that I listened to and television I watched was all that these judges, just who were celebrated by the community for many years, all of a sudden were evil, and they were taking millions of dollars for sending kids away in a private for-profit prison. I'm like, well, how does that happen? And, right. And just curiosity, and I really became very curious about the story.
Well, Terry, let me turn to you, and then Marsha, I'll get to you. And Terry, when did you begin to write about this story?
Well, the actual Kids for Cash angle, the charges were filed in 2009, but we were actually writing about the story and Chivarella's draconian sentences. Well before then, back in 2004, we first became aware of him jailing juveniles for, you know, relatively minor offenses. But the things really took off in the years preceding to 2009 when the charges were filed, and we were doing some additional investigative work because we had some suspicions about the juvenile detention center and that the judges had a financial interest in it. So we were writing on this for a very long time.
So Chivarella was known for these harsh sentences back in 2004, almost a decade ago? Or about a decade ago?
He had always been a very harsh sentencer. He had a zero-tolerance policy regarding any type of offense that was committed in school. It didn't matter if you stabbed a teacher or if you got in a fist fight in a hall. If it happened in school, he sent you away. He was just very, 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 very strict, very zero-tolerance policy.
Marsha, let me turn to you. And the film talks about this was after Columbine. There was a lot of zero tolerance policies instituted in schools. Young people were looked, I think, with some degree of suspicion, misbehavior dealt with pretty harshly. Is that the environment, the atmosphere that you got involved in?
Well, we came into the case because of Hillary Transu's story that was reflected someone being arrested for what was an unbelievably minor and trivial offense, creating a fake MySpace page. And when we began to do our own investigation, what became increasingly clear to us was that there was a very pervasive pattern, both of how Chivarella handled the kids who came before him and his desire to have kids refer to him from the schools to, in effect, really implement his own very, very harsh zero tolerance policies.
And I'm curious, as you began to put this story together, Robert May, and began to sort of see the other side as you describe it, do you think at least initially there were untoward questions raised about these two judges?
Well, I think, you mean in the community
or
like prior to 2009?
Yeah.
Yeah, there were. And I think that what I remember reading about prior to 2009 was that these judges, well, particularly Chiavarella, was zero tolerance. Everybody knew that in the
right.
community. I mean, I thought it was a good thing, too. I have two kids, and they're now teenagers, and I thought, well, it makes sense. You know, you just tell them don't do this, and these are tough consequences if you do it, and they'll be fine. Of course, I didn't know what I know now. And so I think the community thought that way, too. So they had a tough they had a tough reputation. And there's always some side of a judge's opinion that someone doesn't like as well. So I don't think as a regular citizen you don't necessarily know, well, are they corrupt or not.
Well, Terry, let me go back to you, and this it's a complicated story, and as I say, we have talked about this before on Radio Times, but it began, I guess, with the need to build some new juvenile facilities. Conahan finds a businessman named Robert Powell to set up a, I guess, private for-profit detention center for juveniles and gets a builder named Miracle to build it. Take the story from there.
Well, yeah, Mr. Conahan, Judge Conahan, had reached out to Powell to build this private center, and the Luzerne County Juvenile Detention Center at the time that existed wasn't deplorable condition. I don't think anybody disputes that, and they needed to have a new center. They tried to get the county to build one, and they never did it, so he reached out to Powell, who got Robert Miracle involved, and they got the center built. But there was always suspicion that the judge had some type of financial tie because we knew that, or that's Judge Conahan, because he was a childhood friend of Robert Powell's. And so we thought, you know, something funny is going on here. And we did a lot of right-to-know requests and tried to get documents, but we were stonewalled at every corner that we went to try and expose this. Eventually it did come out, you know, once the charges were filed, though.
Well, and a finder's fee. Marsha Levick, I'm looking at you. A finder's fee.
A finder's fee, which apparently Chiavarella relied upon Robert Miracle to tell him whether or not that was legal.
Which is in the film.
Yes, in the film. You know, I think that one of the interesting pieces of this story, I think, for us at Juvenile Law Center was recognizing that Chiavarella was who he was in terms of how he dealt with kids. He had little regard for their constitutional rights. He was happy to take them out of their homes and lock them up in facilities. What changed in his behavior after 2003 when this facility opened, the new facility opened in Luzerne County, a term that we use is that he kind of went from being a rookie to being a professional. He figured out how he could also make some money by continuing to lock kids up. The notion that it was Kids for Cash, that he was literally getting $300 for every child he locked away is not true. That's not how it unfolded. But the amounts of money that exchanged hands, of course, have now been documented and by the U.S. attorney, and the story of that prosecution is out there.
Sure. But was that or is that quid pro quo or this whole finder's fee business?
You know, I think that to me, the information that I know, we've been involved in several different phases of litigation involving Chiavarella and involving the story. Based on what I know, I think that greed played a role, a very strong role, in the kinds of decisions that he was making. It corrupted his participation as a judge, his ability to function as a judge. And I think also, this is something that Robert and I have talked a lot about, is to recognize that the money, the scandal, is what pulls us all in. That's a sexy piece of the story.
Right.
But there's a much bigger story there. And part of that story is thinking about kids' rights and how they should be treated and respected in the courtroom. But it's also a story about what happens in the juvenile justice system every day across the country. And I think that the film is a doorway into that and really the beginning of that conversation.
And I do want to pick up on that. But let me go back to you, Robert May. You got these two judges to sit down and talk to you, be interviewed for this film. It sounds like either their lawyers didn't know about it, or I don't know if they knew about it or not.
Well, they didn't know about it. It was their choice not to tell their lawyers. They felt that if they told their lawyers, they would tell them not to do it. And we weren't going to make the movie unless we could get access to the judges, because we felt that it would be a one-dimensional story on the other side. And, you know, people want to be entertained. You know, when they go to the movies, they want to be entertained. And we didn't know if the film would be entertaining. We know now it's entertaining, and people say it is, but we didn't know then. But, you know, it's one of those classic stories. You have the villain and the victim in the same story, only this was true. So we wanted to get the villain in the story, and the judges knew they were the villains.
Why did they want to talk, though? What?
Well, because they felt, I think they both felt that it was a one-dimensional story, too, and that any good they might have done in their career or in their life was certainly obliterated by the various mm-hmm. stories. And my approach to them was rather simple. I said, listen, you know, we want to tell the story, and we want to tell the story if we can tell both sides of the story. And I think based on the other work that we've done, they did their research and they felt like, okay, we're going to do an honest portrayal of their story. And so they agreed to do it.
And how many hours of interviews? I mean, we see it in the film. Obviously, it's been edited down. But how much time did you spend with these judges?
Well, we spent many days over the course of years with the judges and the families. I mean, collectively, we have 600 hours of footage, but that's not all with the judges and families. Right. We have some kids and families that aren't in the movie and other characters, too. But a lot of time. And any time that we spent with them was very intense and, you know, very long interviews, if you will.
And what did you personally want to know? As the director, producer of this
film? Well, first of all, I didn't go into this, whether I was talking to the judges, the kids and families, with any judgment of my own at all. I just didn't. I mean, it's not who I am. I mean, like, everybody has a story, and I think we're often too quick to judge people at the first sign of accusation or indictment or whatever. I mean, it happened to the kids, and I felt it could happen to the judges. I think it could happen to any one of us. So my idea was just to be, you know, genuinely interested, which I was. And I think, you know, all of our interviewing process is sort of unique in that, you know, we talk about a lot of things before we talk about the actual questions. And, you know, it's about getting trust and gaining comfort from people you're speaking with and holding true to that. And I think they felt that I was going to do that.
Terry, about a minute before our first break here, but had you interviewed these two judges before or during this whole unfolding scandal?
I had spoken with Chivarella. I never spoke with Conahan. Most of my conversations with Chivarella were off the record. And, you know, I was able to gain some insight from those, but he knew that he shouldn't be talking to me and that, you know, he never told his attorneys that he was speaking with me either. But, yeah, I was never able to get him to go on the record. So I give Robert kudos for that. I was really surprised when I found out that they were in the film. So.
And Marcia, we're almost up in a break here, but it's interesting the judges are talking to reporters, filmmakers, without their lawyer's knowledge or agreement.
Shocking.
Is it My shocking guess is to you?
Yeah, I'm sure their lawyers weren't too happy about it when they found out about it. It's, you know, it's a folly for them to do that because particularly at that point in time, they were actually still involved in the criminal prosecution. It may say something about their own arrogance in terms of their need to have their story told, regardless of what the consequences might have been.
We are talking about a new film, a documentary called Kids for Cash, opens in Philadelphia later this week and across the country as well. Talking with the director and producer, Robert May, Marcia Levick from the Juvenile Law Center, and staff reporter Terry Morgan Biesecker from the Scranton Times Tribune. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY as part of the Strauss 150th Anniversary Year. Legendary pianist Emmanuel Axe joins the Philadelphia Orchestra to perform the youthful Burlesque, plus the first piano concerto of Johann Sebastian Bach. And Vladimir Yurovsky conducts Bach's Second Suite. Tickets online at philorg.org or at 215-893-1999. This Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Kimmel Center, Emmanuel Axe, Vladimir Yurovsky, and the Philadelphia Orchestra.
I'm Marty Moscowane. It's another icy, cold, and frustrating day in the Delaware Valley. Don't let the bad weather problems prevent you from becoming a supporter of WHYY. Our membership drive continues because, like you, we have bills to pay, and the way we pay for them is through listener support from people just like you. We're here for you. Now, please be here for us. Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499. Make a pledge of support, 1-888-345-WHYY, and you can also pledge online at WHYY.org. If you're a member of WHYY, we thank you for doing your part and for listening during this drive. Your contribution is the lifeblood of the station and what we do. If you've never been a supporter, you're new to the area or new to public media, take the next step and become a member. Pick up the phone and make a call, 1-888-345-9499. Pledge online at WHYY.org. Thanks very much. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. For a number of years, children and teenagers in Luzerne County, Pennsylvania, who committed petty offenses faced stiff sentences in Judge Civarella's courtroom. Many had no legal representation and were often whisked off to detention centers in handcuffs. Civarella and another judge, Michael Conahan, are now in prison for financial crimes. This case has come to be known as Kids for Cash, which also happens to be the name of a new movie, a documentary that opens this week. Robert May is the director and producer of this documentary. Marsha Levick, deputy director of the Juvenile Justice Law Center here in Philadelphia, which played a pivotal role in this story. And on the telephone is Terry Morgan Biesecker, staff reporter for the Scranton Times Tribune, and had been covering this story for a number of years. And again, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. I do want to quote something that Judge Civarella says in your documentary, Robert. And this is a quote here. He says, this is about explaining these payments and sending children off to these detention centers. He said, I had two choices. I could take the money and report it. And if I wasn't going to report it, don't take it. Well, I chose to take the money and not report it. But do I think it was a crime? No. Did I think I was committing an ethical violation? Absolutely. And the dark side is I wasn't strong enough ethically to not do it. I was concerned how people would perceive a juvenile court judge getting a finder's fee from the person who built the facility wouldn't be perceived too well. He says so many almost contradictory things in those couple of sentences.
Right, and that's the journey we were on with him, because we would hear something like that, and you know that he was justifying one side of ethics and not on the other side of ethics. And I mean, because he could have opted to not take the money at all, or to take the money and then quit as a judge.
Well, let me turn to you, Marsha, as a lawyer here in Pennsylvania. If you're a judge in this state, can you get a finder's fee from an outside organization or company?
The answer is really complicated, but there are certain minimal things that would be true. Certainly any funds that he receives from an outside source, he would have to report, not just to the federal government, but he'd have to report it to entities in Pennsylvania in terms of clearing, again, judicial ethics questions. It's also critical that when judges preside, they must preside in an impartial manner. And when you have taken money from someone who has an interest in the cases that you're presiding over, that's an absolute conflict of interest. And that's really what happened here. He took money from the builders of the facility. He then heard cases of children who he then sent to that facility. It's very clear.
And Terry, going to you, and part of, I guess, what got these two judges in prison was that they did not report this, I guess, on their tax return. So the money wasn't reported.
Right. It was a tax issue, and it was also a violation of the ethics that led to some criminal charges as well. And again, it just reiterates Chevrolet's longstanding point that, you know, he acknowledges he took the money, it was a finder's fee, and that it was an ethical violation. He didn't know it was a crime, but he still swears up and down that he didn't take it to put kids in jail, that it was simply a misunderstanding on his part. He did not understand the law, and, that's what he says. He maintains that to this day.
In fact, Robert, in this film, Judge Civarella talks about the fact that he asks the builder, Miracle, who's offering these finder's fees, saying to him, is that legal? Is it legal to accept a finder's fee?
He did, and he knew the builder for a very long time because the builder grew up next to him literally as a boy and went off and came educated, came back, and so that's he knew him for a long time. And so he trusted the builder, you know, in a relationship, if you will. And the builder, quite frankly, that's the way real estate works. He said, I pay finder's fees all the time. This is what we do. The problem was that conversation happened in the judge's chamber, when literally the builder went into the chamber and said, today's your lucky day. You know, I can pay a finder's fee.
Do you think, Marsha, that the justice was done by this verdict? I mean, essentially they were found guilty of, largely speaking, financial crimes, not so much for what happened in the courtroom and any sort of kids for cash deal.
I do think that justice was done. I think that in terms of the legal prosecution, They were prosecuted for a series of crimes mostly associated with the financial transactions, wire fraud, mail fraud, etc. They were convicted on a substantial number of those allegations and those charges. They're serving a sentence for those charges. Other things that went on in the courtroom in terms of the violations of the kids' rights, there have been other remedies for that. We have received substantial financial damages from both the builder, Robert Miracle. We have the beginnings of a settlement. We're awaiting final approval with the facilities themselves, which have led to jointly about $20 million for their children and their families. So we have always, we at Juvenile Law Center, have always approached the violations that occurred here. They were multifaceted, and we've tried to attack them through a variety of legal channels that were available to us.
Terry, final question to you, and you have interviewed a lot of the people in this film, part of your reporting for the Scranton Times Tribune. And there is a scene near the end of this film where a distraught mother, Sandy Kenzikowski, whose son Ed had been sentenced by Judge Chivarella. He sadly later committed suicide, but she is heard screaming at this judge as the verdict is being written. And I wonder what you could tell us about this mother and also sort of where things stand today in Luzerne County.
Well, I mean, the stories were just absolutely heartbreaking, and particularly Sandy's. She really had an effect on me, you know, personally and professionally, covering the story. And just when you realize that somebody loses a son and the circumstances that led to that, it is just absolutely heartbreaking. And all the stories, really had an impact on me. In terms of how things stand today, there have been some significant changes in the juvenile justice system here that grew out of this. The Interbranch Commission on Juvenile Justice held some hearings, and they came up with a large number of suggestions on how to improve the system, and it appears that it has turned around. But we still need to have people watching. We still need to watch dogs out there to make sure that something like this doesn't happen again, and that's why we have people like the Juvenile Law Center. I'm sure, Marcia, you're still looking at this every day.
She's nodding her head, yes. Yes. Let me get, before we say goodbye to you, Terry, let me get, it looks like Michael from Pennington, New Jersey, to join us. Michael, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
This sounded to me more like something out of West Virginia, the most corrupt state in the country.
Let's not pile on here, but just, Michael, if you don't mind, just getting to your point.
My question is this causing more investigations around the country for profit, for prisons for profit?
Okay.
And is it being looked into elsewhere? Because it just seems to me that, you need product, and somebody is going to figure out a way to supply that product and probably try to figure out how to make money doing it.
Well, Michael, let me take your call and actually toss it to you, Marcia Levick.
Well, I think that Michael's right. If you build a jail for profit, you need to fill it. And we listen to that, and we know there's something is wrong with that picture. There have been actually a number of investigations about the private for-profit prison industry in this country. It is more active on the adult side than it is in the juvenile side, although there are a handful of states. Florida is one where there is a substantial investment by the private for-profit prison corporations that are building and running facilities there. I think it's the right question to ask. I think that we have it was something that was left on the table, frankly, by the Interbranch Commission and by the state in terms of tackling whether we even want to do business with private for-profit providers in the state. And I think it's a question that we need to keep looking at very carefully.
And to you, Robert May, to me, it wasn't so much West Virginia. It was like 19th century America. It was just, and we've done so many shows on this. And every time watching your film, talking about this, I just have this sense of outrage.
Well, I think it's funny because the caller refers to, West Virginia. I don't know if he lives there or did live there. But the thing is, it could be Boston, it could be Philadelphia, it could be Chicago, it could be Miami, it could be Los Angeles. I mean, the fact is corruption, it's kind of in our DNA, too. And I think that, until people pay more attention, unless it happens to them, no one seems to care about it.
Terry, let me say goodbye to you and thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. That's Terry Morgan Biesecker, staff reporter for the Scranton Times Tribune. Staying with us for the rest of the hour, Robert May, director and producer of this new film, Kids for Cash. Marsha Levick, deputy director, chief counsel of the Juvenile Law Center, which is located here in Philadelphia and played a very important role in exposing what was happening to juveniles in this courtroom in Luzerne County. And joining us now is Lorene Transu, and her daughter, Hillary Transu, was a defendant, if I can say, in Judge Civarilla's courtroom. And Hillary and her mother are featured in this film. And Lorene, nice to have you with us on Radio Times once again.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome. What do you hope this film does?
A lot. I have very high hopes. I think the film should have a profound effect on how our society looks at the way our school system deals with children, how our juvenile system deals with children, and I think at the heart of it is really taking a look at zero tolerance policy and understanding that it is not effective for children, and that it sort of set the scene for the abuse of these children in Luzerne County and unfortunately in other areas across the nation.
I do want to pick up on that. And Marsha referenced your daughter, Hillary. She made a fake MySpace page about what it was a principal in her school, yes?
Yes. And, you know, I'd be happy to talk about that. But I think the biggest point that folks need to hear about these, I always call them her special crime, these so-called crimes the children committed, the majority of them were very minor. Of course, there are times when children misbehave and there are serious consequences, but that's the whole thing with zero tolerance, is that by this judge coming into the school and saying to Hillary in this auditorium in her school, if any of you ever come before me, I will send you away. And that's not justice. That's not tolerance. That truly is zero tolerance. So the crime really doesn't matter. But, yes, Hillary did create a MySpace page about her vice principal.
And how long did she, how much time did she spend in the detention facility?
She was initially sentenced to 3 months. The way the system basically works is the court took, they adjudicated her delinquent, so they took custody of her. She would go to the camp for 3 months, at which time she would return to court, and then the judge would then decide if she had been punished enough, learned her lesson, whatever, and then the judge would decide whether to return her to that camp, another facility, return her to her parents. It would have been decided at that 3 month period. However, we were extremely fortunate. I get choked up when I say it. Excuse me.
That's all right.
But we were very fortunate that we eventually got to Bob Schwartz and Marsha Levick at the Juvenile Law Center, and I really feel like they saved Hillary's life and, you know, the lives of other children who would have been sent away.
Lorene, let me turn to Marsha. And again, we've talked about this before, but I want to make sure our listeners understand, in many cases, these were children, teenagers. They were not given, they didn't have a lawyer. These procedures lasted a couple minutes, maybe at the most, and many of them shackled and put in a van and sent off to a detention center.
That's exactly what happened. And in Luzerne County, in front of Civarella, more than half of the kids appeared in his courtroom without lawyers. I think an important statistic is to also understand that about two-thirds of those kids who appeared without lawyers were placed. So it's a very telling statement about the value that lawyers have, the importance of someone speaking for the child in that courtroom. I just also wanted to underscore the point that Lorene is making is that as Robert also has this portrayed at the end of the film, 95% of the kids who go through the juvenile justice system go through that system for nonviolent crimes. We hear stories about violent crime committed by juveniles, and we tend to assume that that's what the system is about. It's not. It's about the kids who are portrayed in Kids for Cash, kids who commit petty offenses, as you said, who get caught up in a system that is not designed to manage their behavior. Mm. That behavior can be managed by schools, by communities, by Loreen Transu herself, obviously, which is what ultimately happened. Chivarella really upended and kind of turned that system inside out in a way that really did an enormous disservice to the community in Luzerne County.
Robert May, in this film, a number of people that worked in the courthouse had testified and talked. I mean, what's so confounding is that this is a courthouse. This is a courtroom. And so people must have known what was going on, and yet it went on.
Well, I guess the question is, what did they think was going on? I mean,
yes.
They knew that kids were being treated, you know, with a zero tolerance approach and policy. And we've screened this film in the pre-release status now in almost every major city as we work to our release. And we had people over in Norman said, oh, that could be here if it's from the advocacy community or if it's from a judge. But the public would have no idea whatsoever. Mm-hmm. They just don't know. So I think the idea that, sure, that people may have thought, oh, this is the wrong way to treat a kid, but they weren't saying anything. In fact, the interesting thing, there was a lawyer in every one of the proceedings. The prosecutor was there. Well, you know, doesn't the prosecutor have an obligation to look out for kids too?
Loreen, let me go back to you and find out, how is Hillary doing?
She's doing fantastic. There are definitely residual effects. But that's why I said Hillary was so fortunate, because through Juvenile Law Center's involvement, they helped to give Hillary a voice to start speaking early about what was going on with her, to try and help other families. And then, of course, this film just really gave all the kids a voice, and, you know, that has helped so much. And I just think the important thing I know to Hillary, she said many times, is that she was listened to by Juvenile Law Center, by Marsha, by Robert, and that helped her. If these kids had been listened to right from the beginning and gotten the support they needed, their lives would have been so different. So, again, that's why I really feel like this, Juvenile Law Center, Robert, the investigation, the media attention, it just has made such a huge difference and really saved Hillary's life. She's a grad student now.
Wow.
She's doing fantastic. But she's a beautiful girl inside and out. And I've often said if she wasn't my daughter, I'd want her for my friend.
Well, that's a really wonderful thing that you just said, Loreen. We're all tearing up here. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. That's Loreen Transu and her daughter, Hillary Transu, featured in this film, Kids for Cash. The film is opening later this week about two judges in Pennsylvania, juvenile justice system, sending young people like Hillary Transu off to detention centers, often without legal representation, often without any actual trial that took place. We're talking with the director, producer of Kids for Cash, Robert May, and also with Marsha Levick from the Juvenile Law Center. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Speaker Series, presented by Widener University, continuing its sold-out season at the Kimmel Center on February 24th with former U.S. Poet Laureate Billy Collins. Sponsored by WHYY and the Haverford Trust Company.
Supporting WHYY, Rutgers University, offering graduate degree programs entirely online and now accepting applications. More information at radioonline.rutgers.edu. Rutgers University proudly supports WHYY.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're in the middle of the winter membership campaign here at WHYY, and we're in the middle of some challenging winter weather, which is making it hard for all of us to get around, to get to work, and figure out what to do with the kids who are home from school once again. We're here for you with the kind of news and information that you rely on to keep you informed, no matter what the weather is. On Radio Times today, we're discussing Pennsylvania Governor Tom Corbett's budget address yesterday and the upcoming governor's race. Then a discussion about a new film called Kids for Cash, about a scandal involving two Pennsylvania judges who are in prison. The documentary and our discussion is about how these judges were found out. That's why you listen to Radio Times. We have the time to go deep and go long, to get beyond the headlines and the sound bites. What's that worth to you? $5, $10, $20 a month? You decide and make this phone call. It's 1-888-345-9499. You can also pledge online at whyy.org. Thanks. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Robert May and with Marsha Levick. Robert May, the director and producer of Kids for Cash. He's also produced several other documentaries through his production company, Sen Art Films, including the Oscar-winning documentary, The Fog of War, 11 Lessons from the Life of Robert S. McNamara, and The Station Agent. Marsha Levick, deputy director, chief counsel of the Juvenile Law Center, which she co-founded with Bob Schwartz back in 1975. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Robert, there are a lot of kids that had been sent to these detention centers in your film, and I have to say their moving, heartfelt stories are I think the most compelling part of the film. Was it hard to get them to talk? Did they want to talk to you about what had happened to them? Because it's painful stuff.
It is. Like, in fact, Amanda, who's in the film, when we talked to her aunt about interviewing her, she said that, you know, Amanda has never talked about this. And they've had her talk to a psychologist, and she simply wouldn't talk about it. But there was something about her story that interested us. And she literally, for the very first time, started to tell her story to us on camera. And, you know, but it was a matter of trust. I think it was just a matter of the atmosphere was the right time, whatever. But we tried to make it very safe for the kids and families.
Yeah.
And again, we weren't there to pass any judgment at all. I have great respect for all of the kids and families who we portray, and also kind of who they represent elsewhere as well.
Well, and she, I mean, we see at the end, she graduates from high school, very exciting, and she looks fantastic. But it's also clear that she was very troubled by this, had been treated and perhaps is still treated for depression and anxiety. So she's paid a hard psychological price for what she went through.
She did. And you know, one of our other films, nonfiction films, was The War Tapes. And we followed these National Guardsmen who went to Iraq for a year and their families and juxtaposed their stories. Well, that's the first time I really understood what PTSD was. And now understanding that we're in another story where kids have PTSD, a lot of kids have PTSD after they come out of the system. And they're paranoid, literally. They're afraid of authority figures. They look over their shoulder. I mean, it's incredible the kind of damage that happens to kids that go into the system.
And there's a heartbreaking story. I'll put this to you, Marsha. This Charlie Balasavage, and he was sent off to a detention center because his parents, it sounded like, had bought what was a stolen bicycle.
Yes. Each of the stories that are portrayed in the film depict the lunacy that was going on in Luzerne County. But I think the Charlie story grabs us because, yes, his parents bought him a scooter that turned out to be a stolen scooter. And Charlie ends up being charged with receiving stolen property and ends up in and out of the system. Shivarella really created a revolving door. Ultimately spent about 4 years, 5 years in the system. There's a very, I think, moving moment in the film where Charlie talks about every significant moment that one would experience between the ages of 14 and 18. He spent in some facility somewhere. He missed it all. He missed all of high school for something that never should have caught the attention of either law enforcement or the juvenile justice system.
Well, and it does raise questions, and we meet some parents here, obviously, you know, struggling to understand the system. And I have to say, you know, his mother is – she's just heartbroken about what happened to her son, Charlie. But it's clear people don't know how the system is supposed to work.
They don't know how the system is supposed to work. And I think that Luzerne County also reminds us how if you allow people to come of age in a community where they feel disempowered, they will never have the ability to challenge even the most obvious things that are going on around them. And I think that the film, again, it portrays both the parents' frustration and the parents' desire to do well by their kids and not knowing how to go about it. And also, to your point that you raised earlier, I think the silence in the courtroom. While parents may not be expected to know how the juvenile justice system should treat their children, we do think prosecutors should know how the system should work. We think defense counsel should know how the system should work, who were in that courtroom on any given day. And the conspiracy of silence that unfolded among the professionals in Luzerne County who allowed the treatment of kids to go on year after year after year is, I think, another really important part of the story that we all need to be paying attention to.
In fact, in the film, a public defender, Basil Russin, basically says, you know, it wouldn't have mattered if there had been attorneys there anyway because Judge Chivarella was a tough judge and he was going to send them away anyway.
Right. I mean, that's what his attitude was. It's like he was going to be the judge over the situation. Charlie's story is complex. It unfolds in the film. You learn more about that decision to send him away. Right. But, I mean, you know, he felt like he was going to be the parent. If he felt like someone was a bad parent, he was going to take over and be the parent.
And Charlie, he reads a poem, you know, part of this, he reads a poem. And I have to say there's such a sweetness about him. And we see that he gets in trouble later in life as well, involving credit cards, and is back in prison, although apparently he's out now.
I think the revelation, like for me in this film, and I think for others too, is that we just assume that people and kids get caught up in the wrong side of the law are dumb, or they're somehow inadequate. And the fact is that's just not the case. Like, these kids were smart kids, not well educated, unfortunately, because their education was ripped from them, but very, very articulate. All the kids that are in this film are very articulate.
Yes, they are.
And they're very creative and very smart. We have one that has a genius IQ, you know, loves music, wrote a song that's in the movie. So that's the sort of the revelation people have to really, you know, take off those filters and look, peer inside who these kids really are.
Marcia, you mentioned zero tolerance, and I think it's interesting that the Attorney General, Eric Holder, has been talking about let's rethink zero tolerance, that we're perhaps overcharging young people. I think this film is a good example of that. But do you think the country's beginning to rethink this policy of zero tolerance?
We can only hope. The Attorney General's comments, along with Secretary Duncan from a couple of weeks ago, where the Attorney General finally recognized we need to start rolling back these policies. They have particularly adverse consequences for kids of color, for kids with disabilities. Columbine was in 1999. It's 2014. It's taken us 15 years to get national leadership to recognize that this is a practice that has gone completely awry. So I welcome it. We're grateful for it. I think it's late, and I think it remains to be seen whether or not we'll see real action on the ground.
Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. We have Samantha from South Philadelphia joining us on Radio Times. Samantha, go ahead. You're on the air. Hi there.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Thanks for making this movie. I really want to go see the movie, but I'm from Hazleton, Pennsylvania, where Judge Conahan is from. But the thing that I'm struggling with listening to this conversation is, how did the judges get compensated for making this movie? Because I think that's important to know, and I assume that they were compensated. It makes me struggle internally to go see the movie knowing that they'd been compensated.
Well, we don't know that, Samantha. Let me give Robert May a chance to respond.
No. In fact, none of the films we've ever done, nonfiction films, none of the subjects are compensated. And they're not compensated for a very important reason. If we were doing a reality show, that would be different. But it's because we want them to tell their story for the sake of wanting to tell their story, not for the sake of financial gain. And that was true with the families, the kids, the judges, every person in the film. No one was paid in any way to speak on camera.
Kind of like a courtroom should be, right, Marcia?
That is how we hoped it would be. Good point.
Samantha, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me see what Tracy from Yardley has to say. Tracy, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thank you. And
you're welcome.
I also echo, I'm thrilled the movie's being made. I just wanted to share, I was working in Bucks and Montgomery County at the time in support of probation officers. The time that the story broke, I was doing an overnight retreat for about 25 young men that were in the, you know, juvenile justice system. They had been taken out of their homes, and we were doing an overnight weekend, and they brought in the newspaper that weekend. And the result was we had to bring in, you know, double, triple, almost the staff that we usually have because the far-reaching effects of what this particular courtroom did reached other counties and probably other states. You know, the news reached the young people that are in the system sure. elsewhere, some for very good reasons. Some, I don't know if they were victims in any way, but they certainly used this as an opportunity to feel like a victim in the system, and it just really made it difficult for them to get help that they needed and to trust adults.
Well, Tracy,
anyway, after that.
Yeah, I mean, you raise a really good point, which is, you know, this is a story, yes, it affected these children, but it has had far-reaching effects, Marcia.
It has, and I think that Robert and I have participated in screenings, as he mentioned, that have been going on around the country. And in every audience, although the response is somewhat different, in every audience there is a moment of recognition about pieces of the film that resonate within their communities, whether it's what was going on inside the courtroom, concerns about over-incarceration, concerns about private for-profit facilities. All of these are issues that the film, as I said at the beginning, really is a doorway into a much broader conversation that I think we've seen unfold in a small scale way across the country, where there is enormous interest in people seeing if that's what goes on behind closed doors in one county in northeastern Pennsylvania, the juvenile justice system, which in most jurisdictions continues to carry on its work behind closed doors, there is this recognition that we need to start opening those doors and looking inside.
Robert May, if I can go back to the film and actually to the two judges, and it looks like Judge Conahan acknowledges, he says, I was corrupt. I mean, he acknowledges to some degree his crime, not so much for Chivarella.
Well, Chivarella does acknowledge the crimes that he was generally convicted on. I mean, he acknowledges that he took money. He shouldn't have taken the money. He should have reported it. He should have paid all the taxes on it and all that. What he doesn't admit to, and will, you know, die not admitting to, is that he literally traded kids for cash, or did he? You see the movie, and so I think, you know, that's where it landed.
Well, and it seems that he feels betrayed by Conahan.
Right. There's a number of twists and turns in the film that. That I think are rather entertaining for those that will be entertained by the film. And there's plenty of. I mean, they don't call it a riveting thriller, which rivals most fiction for nothing.
Is that a quote?
That's a quote from The Hollywood Reporter. We've had many quotes. Stephen Ray did his review this morning. He called it chilling. That's what it is. Those are the kind of words you describe. Kerry Rickey, a horror, like a horror movie. I mean, that's the way we felt while we were developing it as well. And in fact, it has those elements. It has all those various story elements: betrayal, greed, children. It's all of those elements are in this one story.
And the story we're talking about is Kids for Cash, and that's Robert May. He's the director and producer of this new documentary. Also with us, Marcia Levick, deputy director, chief counsel of the Juvenile Law Center here in Philadelphia. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Marcia, you wanted to say something. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to add to the list of things that Robert just mentioned were in the film. There's also denial. And there are moments in the film where Chivarella, and he's said this publicly even before we saw it on camera, that, for example, he never denied a child their right to counsel. There is a trail of paper, transcripts, that were reviewed by the special master who was appointed by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court to review these cases. There's not a lot of question about what went on in his courtroom and, again, how he treated these kids and his absolute willingness to allow thousands of kids to appear before him without counsel. But that's part of the story. It is part of the story.
Let me get looks like Lynn to join us on Radio Times. And, Lynn, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you.
Hi.
I think this program has been really good at showing some of the lessons learned from what happened in Luzerne County. And another one, and I don't know if this was mentioned early in the show before I got on, is it just really highlights the need for all of us as people who use the court systems, for lawyers and for other judges, to you know, who suspect that judges are engaging in misconduct, that they report it to the Judicial Conduct Board. If they're not going to report a discipline complaint, you know, tell a reporter or do something about it. There were just so many reports by lawyers and people who worked in the system that, you know, that they feared reporting it because, you know, they thought there'd be retaliation by judges. But all the more reason that we can't just sit in our hands. And I know that in this case, the discipline system didn't react as well as it should have been. And there have been some changes and need to be more changes.
Sure. Well, Lynn, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And, you know, Lorene Trentz, who called you Marsha Levick, she spoke up.
She did
about
speak
her
up.
About her daughter?
She did speak up. And had she not called us, we may never have had the opportunity to dig deeper in the ways that we did. And for me, I've always thought of Lorene and Hillary as the heroes of the story because they made a lot of things happen that would not have happened if they hadn't questioned what was going on.
We're almost out of time here. What did you learn making this film, Robert May?
I learned that everything I thought I knew about when people do bad things was wrong, whether it be children or otherwise. I mean, I look at my own children differently. This film has had a profound effect on me and my family and my children, and quite frankly, our entire production crew. They've all been sort of affected by this, and you know, it became much more powerful for all of us personally than I had ever imagined it would be.
Well, I thank you for joining us, and I congratulate you on your film, Robert May. Thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having
You're
us.
Welcome. Director and producer of Kids for Cash, Marsha Levick, as always, you know I'm a fan. Thanks for joining us as
thank
well.
You.
And she's deputy director, chief counsel of the Juvenile Law Center here in Philadelphia. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about this program. I should add, Kids for Cash opens Friday at the Ritz at the Bourse, the AMC Cherry Hill, here in the Delaware Valley and across the country. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.